When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you're tired of spending money on trail cameras you use as tools only to find out they're built like freaking toys, or you've struggled with unreliable, not so dependable cameras or experienced customer service that flat out disappointed you, I've been there. Those problems literally birthed Exodus 8 years ago when they shipped their first camera. Exodus had a clear desire to not only build elite products that enabled you to set it and forget it all season long, but also to back them like no other company was willing to, with an unmatched level of customer service and support. See for yourself why Exodus has over 15,000 satisfied customers. They've quickly become known for their 5-year no BS warranty, quality cameras, and best-in-class customer service. You heard that right. Exodus believes in their products so much, every single camera is backed by a 5-year warranty that includes theft and accidental damage coverage. Each camera is checked for quality control standards before it leaves the warehouse. If they wouldn't use it, you don't get it. Exodus is so confident you'll love your new Exodus camera, they're offering you, the listener of this show, 15% off your next order today. Just use code BTE. If you don't love it, get your money refunded in the first 30 days and just send her back. Exodus really has two excellent cell cam options for all budgets, and they start at just $179, plus you're 15% off there. You use the code BTE. They have competitive data plans that allows you to purchase a plan and use the data as you see fit. They want you to be in control. There's no annual commitment and no limit on how many cameras you can run on one plan. You can share cameras with friends, no charge, which makes the Exodus lineup a great option for hunting clubs and leases. There are no additional fees for HD photo requests. That's pretty nice. No additional fees for video uploads. And all cameras share data on a single data plan for easy management. See for yourself why so many have made the switch to Exodus and experienced the Exodus difference. Use code BTE to get 15% off your next order today. Now let's talk about Osseo Gear. It's a great option for whitetail hunters. They develop a premium line of bow hunting gear that will rival any other clothing on the market in quality. Plus, you got a lifetime warranty on anything you buy from Osseo, which is pretty nice. They have a super unique camo pattern and great technology in their garments to keep you comfortable in the stand. So visit asiogear.com, get you some premium hunting clothing. Gotta talk to you about Stealth Outdoors, makers of Stealth Strips. Stealth Strips really are a product that any hunter, whether you're a weekend warrior or a guy that hunts almost every day, really needs to take advantage of. Stuff absolutely deadens your gear to make it essentially noise-free. If you haven't checked out Stealth Strips yet, stop buying all the other crappy alternatives like the hockey tape and any other stuff you're trying to use to silence your gear. Get the good stuff. Get Stealth Strips. Visit stealthoutdoors.com. Pick you up some Stealth Strips. All my partners are linked in the description below. Go check them out. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Hope everybody's doing good tonight. We got Paul, your second time on, I think, now?
Yeah, second time now.
Paul Pachura is on again tonight. We're going to get into a few different things. Yeah, thanks for coming on, dude.
Yeah, no problem.
Me and Paul converse a lot on Facebook Messenger and stuff, but we don't get to talk to each other much. So you texted me the other day about some your experiences with mock scrapes this year.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, we ought to talk about that for a while. We'll talk about some gear stuff because Paul's like my, he's one of my go-tos whenever I'm thinking about tinkering with something or doing something. I'm like, I bet Paul's done this or tinkered with this before. And I'll be sure to ask him before I go too crazy on something.
I haven't done it. I've probably researched somebody else has done it extensively.
Yeah, exactly. So I just wanted to, I thought people would find it interesting. Some of the things that I always respect someone a lot that isn't satisfied with their gear. Like I always, like I look at your gear. I'm like, this guy, he's fine tuning things. Like that's how I look at it. Your attention to detail in your gear and the uniqueness of your gear also is super awesome. Yeah. So I just wanted to talk to you about that. But first I want to talk to you about mock scrapes because I have too been tinkering with mock scrapes the last couple of years and trying to find my path on how to use them. I just was curious about, what you thought of them this year, your technique for setting up some mock scrapes. Cause we hunt, not unlike terrain, you know, the hills here in Indiana are kind of similar to the hills out east. And, a mock scrape seemed to be a very useful way of getting, deer on camera and killing them too, you know?
So,
how did you end up, like, I guess, first of all, like what made you end up deciding to kind of start doing mock scrapes and how long you've been doing them now?
I've always kind of done them off and on and like, but I really got kind of serious the last couple of years into doing them, especially like I started doing them when I started hearing a podcast with Troy Pottinger doing them.
Yeah. Troy is a really big advocate of it. Exactly. Again, another guy that hunts mountains, you know, that, that big stuff that probably hard to get a trail cam picture of a deer sometimes, you know?
Yeah. And it seems to be a really good thing to use in these big woods, you know, with these lower, you got the lower deer densities or patterns are more like nomadic and stuff. So like a scrape can be a fantastic point for these deer. You know, you're not necessarily always hunting the most pressure deer even during the season. It's just, there's just so big and vast and how much they move. And it becomes like a really good focal point to pick up deer and take inventory and learn a lot about them.
I've kind of found the same thing around here the last couple of years. And let's say you're in a system where you're going to put a mock scrape, like how do you go about making a mock scrape?
Well, I always start off looking at terrain extensively in an area, you know, because I got really big sections. So like I'm looking at how the terrain's going to flow, buck travel and buck movement on how the does are going to travel and everything. I want to find a place where all the terrain is going to flow these deer and make an intersection. You know, so you'll be taking terrain features, edge habitats, you know, swamp edges, you got different hardwoods to pines, stuff, laurel thickets, edges on laurels to hardwoods, and I'm trying to find places where all that stuff is going to come together, you know.
Yeah.
And then from there, then I'll go into that location, and usually a lot of times when you look, you probably already start to find old scrape activity and stuff like that. And I'll a lot of times if there's already a scrape there and it's in the right location, I'm just going to take that scrape and doctor it up and start using it. You know, and then I start these things in the summertime. You know, I start them in like June, July, August is when I usually want to start running these things.
And that's, do you find any benefit of like, did you do any during the season or anything this year? Or were you pretty much solely doing them this summer?
Yeah, I still do. I'll do them the whole year. I've been doing them the whole year. Mm-hmm. But like I the ones I started the earliest seem to be the ones that the biggest bucks have been picking up on the best so far. It's like they like come through and they see all this activity before the hunting season, and then they kind of make like a mental note of it or something, and then they all of a sudden they start returning back to it later on closer to the season, you know.
Yeah,
I think these bigger bucks, they get on excursions and stuff more often than people think they do in this bigger woods, you know. I think there's a study that said, I think it was with the Pennsylvania deer study, that a mature buck will have like 30 or 40 different beds, you know, So, like, in these big wood sections, if they got that many beds, they're traveling, you know, they're moving around.
Well, they have
to be. Yeah. You know? So, I think they find these places, and they just make a mental note of it in their head. They're like, wow, there was a lot of deer in this area. I'm going to come back and check this again, you know.
Yep. So. And maybe you don't have any experience with this. I got a little bit, but do you think the mock scrape thing, I mean, would you give it any thought in like farm country habitat?
I think it would probably kind of make sense anywhere you go.
You know,
as long as your deer are going to be finding them, you know.
Yeah.
But it's really important to have them in the right places. That's one right. thing. I think people don't have good luck with it. They're not putting it in the right spot. I think that's what a lot of it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would agree. It's not necessarily even you're going to be getting daylight photos on some of these.
Yeah.
Like the best spot might be all nocturnal activity, but it's a great starting point because you have something, you know.
Yeah.
Some of these places you don't have any sign.
Right.
It's hard to find buck sign or anything. So if you have a focal point where you can get these deer on camera, at least you got something to go off of to go.
That's what I have, you know, in Indiana here, we have more of a mixture of ag than you guys do out east there. And it seems like, you know, all of our public land for the most part is hill country, big hill country. And I have good success with mock scrapes in hill country, but then like I'll put one on a farm, you know, a farm I have or something. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it's just mediocre at best. Like I just think maybe that terrain in the farm country is already seducive to sign. And so I don't find them beneficial as much. Now you can put a mock scrape up and you'll get some pictures, but it just seems like there's better ways of going about finding deer in those features. Yeah. Whereas in hills, I'm big fan of them.
Now, have you ever tried using mock, like finding signpost rubs in a situation like that?
No, not signpost rubs. Mm-mm.
Yeah. Cause it might just be that it's not the right terrain that's inducive to scraping, you know, like,
right.
But if you know where places are where you get a lot of rubs that congregate in an area, you know, that might be something that's the same concept. It's just instead of using a scrape, you're using a rub.
That's something that I have never, like, I mean, I'm not good at rubs. Like I obviously understand rubs in the, you know, reading rubs on how, you know, mature deer, not mature, this or that. But like, I just don't put a lot of stock into them. Is rubs something that you really pay attention to as far as hunting over them?
Absolutely. I use them a lot. And that's one of the things, like, you can really tell a lot what's going on with bucks when you get the rubs going, you know. You can, it really helps you figure out what they are for one.
Yeah.
You can gauge antlers on rubs and stuff like that, but it's not, you're not looking for, there's so many different types of rubs and so many meanings for all these rubs that it's hard to decipher which ones you're actually looking at sometimes. So you got to kind of learn like what is going to be a signpost and what's not. So like a good rub is kind of be set up more like a good scrape, you know? Okay. Going to be more like a hub kind of situation where all this terrain goes together that flows everything in and creates a natural travel form.
Yeah. So you're using the same theories as you would like a scrape that's, you know, mm-hmm. in a good area where they are going to possibly get there during daylight hours. And then there's a lot of terrain features that you like that come together.
And if you take and build a scrape in an area near a signpost rub, a lot of times you get a lot of nice deer.
Yeah.
They just kind of go ahead.
We just have such a lack of rubs here in Indiana just because our deer density numbers are low. And
And I have the same thing.
Yeah, right.
Thing, like you don't see many rubs. Like some places where these big bucks live, you won't find a rub bigger than a pencil.
Yeah.
You're like, how is this buck even here? There's no sign of him, but it's actually, that's the spot you want to be.
Right. You know? I love talking to people on here because it just gets my wheels just completely keeps turning because it's just so much stuff that a guy just figures out and learns. Now, like I went and scouted Iowa a couple of years, and holy cow, I just like there are some areas where there was so much rubbing. I'm like, there's, and you know, it was the particular area I'm thinking in my head. There was a creek that ran into a cornfield, and then the creek teed into a fence row, and right there where everything met, it was just tore up with rubs. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, in Iowa, you got hard to tell how many mature buck lived in that square mile, you know. So I was like, man, this is a hot area for those reasons. And the rubs were there to show you that. Whereas here, I don't find that as much, but something I need to pay attention to more.
Yeah. It's more, you got to find that historical rubs that keep appearing, you know?
Right. And
and they don't get hit every year. Sometimes a big signpost won't get hit every year. But if you put a camera in front of it, you'd be surprised how many bucks walk past it.
Yeah. Just like a scrape. A lot of times
deer walk. It's an intersection where they go through.
Yeah. Right.
The same thing with scrapes though. How many deer go past that scrape that you never saw on the camera?
Yeah. Oh, a bunch of them. Yeah. Yep. What did I was talking to Johnny Stewart about this. You know, he was telling me he thinks like if you get a buck on a camera twice a week, he probably lives right there. You know, you're probably in on him.
Yeah. 100%. Even if he's there at midnight.
Yeah. Right. Cause you know, you're probably only seeing him 5% of the time that he's in that area.
Yeah.
With your camera.
Yeah. And that's what we were talking about the other day. I think I was texting you about that. Mm-hmm. Like you get these big bucks on camera and they're coming in at midnight. Well, what's not there at midnight? Every other deer.
Yeah.
You look at your time frames when your deer come through, and then like you get your younger bucks and your does and your like 3.5-year-old bucks start showing up at certain times, and then all of a sudden, randomly in the middle of the night, when everything calms down, you get this big buck on camera.
Yeah.
You know? And what is he doing? He's living right there, but he ain't going over there until the other deer are moving out of the area, you know, because he just doesn't want to deal with it. Naturally just reclusive animal, you know.
That's a good point. I mean, you can observe that behavior. Like across the road, there's a place that nobody hunts. You're not allowed to hunt it. And there's a green field out there, a wheat field out there, and there'll be a dozen deer out there. Tonight there was. And then without fail, right before dark, like in the opposite corner, there'll be a buck come out.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's the same thing. He lives in there, he's there, but he just kind of avoids the other deer like the plague almost.
Yeah, that's just like through habit with age, they just kind of learn it.
Yeah. And we think about that mentality in a field, in a cornfield or something, because we, you know, you can visually see that happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it's happening everywhere they live. And yeah.
Yeah. It makes you really think about when you're setting up, if you're setting up in the right places, you know, because we're all training ourselves to look for deer sign and find all these scrapes and these rubs and stuff. But is that really where you're going to kill the big buck, you know, or is that where he's going to show up well after dark?
Right. You know? Right.
So you got to really think about, like, do I have to go somewhere completely off the rocker here and not even see a deer to see this buck? And more times than not, that's usually what happens to find them.
Yep. Happened to me the very first year I went and hunted Wisconsin. I shot a really nice buck. I mean, it was like a 135-inch buck. But the first 2 days I was there, I was seeing so many deer. I was seeing, you know, I'd see 4 or 5 dinks and a bunch of does. And finally, after like 2 sets, I'm like, I'm doing something wrong. Like, what is, like, I've never seen this many deer. And we kind of made adjustments, and then I stopped seeing deer. But then, you know, 2 sets later, here comes a big one out.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. And that is thing. It is super hard as a deer hunter that likes seeing deer. You know, deer hunters like to watch deer. It's hard to get that out of your mind that, like, I need to be here because all the deer are here.
You feel like you're doing something wrong because you're not seeing any deer, but you might go you might go a week without seeing a deer, but once you finally see one, you see the buck that you're actually trying to shoot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's like the story of my life when I'm hunting usually. It's like, I don't see a ton of deer.
Yeah.
I don't see a ton of deer when I'm setting up, but eventually once I see that deer, it's the right deer.
Yep. You know? I don't remember what year it was. It was like around like 2018 or 19. I shot a decent buck here in Indiana, but I had like 10 sits in a row that I didn't see a deer. And then on the 11th sit, I saw him. That's the only one deer I saw and shot him. Yeah.
And that's usually what happens when you shoot these older bucks, especially when they're like 4.5, 5.5, 6.5 and above. It's usually, you don't see them with other deer very often.
Yeah. But it's a good lesson. Like people do get frustrated, especially when you start hunting mobily or, you know, more of this type of mindset that you're talking about, Paul, because people get frustrated with it and give up because they're not seeing deer. They think they're doing something wrong. And in reality, like you're right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Unless you're like, I don't know, Andy May or someone, you just seem to shoot one every time you set up on one.
which is like when I set up, I usually have a pretty high percentage of seeing the buck I'm looking for.
Yep. No, that's true.
But like I go many days without setting up. You know, I go a lot of days just kind of being passive, staying out of it, and then kind of like trying to get a grasp on what's going on without intruding too much to interfere. And then when I feel like I know what's going on, then I'll make my move and get in there.
Yeah. You know?
But I'll just kind of stay on the background and just kind of look at night sign and like, oh, look, it looks like a big buck might have traveled from that direction out to this destination point in the middle of the night. You know, it's like, okay, so he's probably over there. And then you go scout another area surrounding that spot. And you're like, okay, yeah, look, there's another run that looks like a big buck is using coming that way from the same direction. You know, and then you kind of, you put all the pieces together and you're like, okay, that buck is probably coming from right here. You know, and then you make a move and get in there. You know,
if you had to put into percentages or numbers, like how many sits do you sit a year versus like, do you spend, is it common for you to go out hunting somewhere and just end up scouting all evening?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I wander around a lot. I do a lot, you know. During the season, I'm not aggressive with my scouting. I'm not like blasting through trying to get right on top of them, but I'm staying well enough back though. I don't feel like I'm interfering with what there might be betting in, but I'm kind of poking around the edges, kind of like, okay, are they coming out this way or are they coming out this side more right now? You know, because if they're using a certain betting area, you know, they might only come out a certain direction based on certain food sources throughout the season. So like you think you got a buck on camera and he just stops coming out and you think he's not there anymore. But in reality, he's just going 180 degrees out the other way.
Yeah.
You know, and he's going to some other oak flat or some other feature that he wants to go travel to, you know, but he might actually be physically bedding in the same location. You're just missing him. You know,
yeah.
Which, like, if you're gonna run cameras on a buck like that in a bedding area, you really kind of have to surround it. You know, you gotta run like you're running a trap line. You put a trap line around the perimeter on every trail that comes out. You know, and see what trail he's actually using. You know, and you don't have to worry about using cell cameras or anything for that because it's coming out in dark.
Yeah,
he's coming way out. Out, you're not even close to where he's actually laying. You're just getting your nighttime pictures. You know, I want to have pictures of him like an hour or two after dark exiting. You know,
How far do you think? I know this is a horrible question, but like, how far do you think a deer will move an hour after dark? Like, if you get him a picture of him an hour and a half after legal light, I mean, how far do you think he is from that area?
He could be a lot closer than you think he is. You know?
Yeah.
And a lot of times I think that's often the case because they'll come out and they'll start farting around and feeding and stuff and doing your thing, and an hour goes by pretty quick.
Yeah. You know? I watched a, and this is in Kansas, mind you. So like I watched a buck this year. It was in the morning and it was probably like a 160 type deer, but mm-hmm. I watched him. I was 100 yards from him, and I watched him cover about, I would say 70 yards. It took him an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen that many a times too, especially hunting in September. When I'm hunting, I hunt a lot more open terrain, grassland, marshes in September where I can really yep. see far. And like I could watch a buck working this little island out there in the grass, feeding on acorns. He doesn't even move. He might not ever come out of there. He might mingle around in that spot for days on end before he leaves it.
Yeah. You know? Now I saw him out in the field, in a CRP field, not a. You know, he had some cover in it, but he got into the woods. That was like a tornado went through the woods. So it was all layovers, and he got inside that woods and just was in no hurry at all to go anywhere. I mean, he would take maybe five steps and he'd just sit there and just slowly look around for a while. And, you know, maybe he may chew on something for a minute and then just look around, and then he would take another five steps. And of course I'm sitting there like watching this big 160, like, come on, dude, do something.
Yeah, it's like, all right, I better. There's nothing you can do. He ain't coming.
No. I grunted at him, snort wheeze, every trick in the book, just because he was going the other way. And he didn't even like flinch about it. I mean, you know, some deer would like, you would snort wheeze at him and they'd be like, you know, and he was just like, he heard me and you could hear him like kind of lift his head up and he just was like,
like,
I mean, like he knew, like, I ain't moving this big giant rack around.
He's like, I know what the deal is.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't going to shoot that deer. But anyway, mock scrapes. Let's get back on that topic. So do you just tell me like, and you don't have to tell me, but what do you use? How do you go about making them? Do you pay attention to scent? Do you wear rubber gloves? Like, what is your philosophy?
I don't believe in scent control at all.
Right.
I don't think it works. I just don't think so. I don't do anything. I just accept the fact that the deer are going to smell my scent in that grape no matter what I do.
Right.
You know, so I don't go crazy with a stick or anything. I go right in there with my boot and I kick the whole thing right out and make it look real nice and get the branches all bent down the way they're supposed to look, you know, and then I'll put some pre-orbital spray from whoever makes it, random companies. You know, I don't really follow any scent companies or nothing. I just spray it on there, and then I'll put some tarsal gland scent in the scrape and call it good, you know. And then the trick is you just back out and let the animals go in there and start farting with it.
Yeah. You know?
Because every time an animal walks in there, they make a scent trail into it, and like you'll get a lot of curious does and stuff coming into that thing right away, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that pre-orbital scent, it's like it's synthetic. It smells like cologne and vanilla extract almost.
Right,
you
know? Right.
You know, so I think it's more of an attractant than it actually is anything that's creating any kind of real response on a scent that the deer would familiarize with an actual deer.
Yeah. You know?
So I think it's just, it's an attractant, you know, and they smell it and then they get their feet in it and then they'll urinate in it and they'll start licking the branches. And then the next deer comes in and be like, well, I smell all weird stuff, but another deer was in here smelling these branches too, you know? So, yeah. And they kind of go off of it, you know?
You ever just pee in them yourself?
Oh yeah. I've done that. You gotta watch too, make sure there's not another trail camera on it when you do
right.
that.
Yep. I just was curious. I mean, some people swear by that. You know, some people swear by just they don't use anything but their own urine.
Some people throw ammonia in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen that too.
Urine breaks down into ammonia. Yep. So, well, that makes sense to me then.
Yeah. A gallon of ammonia is a lot cheaper. That's what I was going to say. A gallon of ammonia from Walmart is a lot cheaper than your synthetic spray.
$4?
Yeah, $4 right.
A gallon. That's a lot of scrapes.
Yeah, some of them, some of those sprays will cost you $400 a gallon for yeah. the spray. But yeah, there's a lot of options for that stuff out there. Now,
I used to make my own like tarsal scent and everything back in the day. You know, but now with the CWD laws, I can't do that in my state.
Yeah.
So I can't be using actual deer products in my scrape. So I just went to using synthetic stuff and whatever.
Yeah.
But like yep. back in the day, I used to take tarsal glands and I soak them in I pack them in a mason jar and I dump hot water on top of them. And then you cap it off and you shake the jar up. And it would like turn, it would take all that stain off the hocks mm-hmm. and put it into the water. And then I would take that water and just the water in the jar and just dump the water into the scrape and put that all in there. And that worked fantastic. I mean, that was the best way I could do it, but can't do it anymore. So I can't do it that way. But
yeah.
You just got to give it more time. You know, like when I used to do it that way, the time period between when I could start the scrape and when I would get a lot of deer really getting into it was a lot shorter.
Hmm. You know, that's interesting.
They like that smell a lot better, you know?
Yep. What about that stuff went rancid after a year or so?
Yeah. Well, I would get all the tarsals and I'd cut them off. I go down to my butcher and I go in there and he let me just cut as many as I want off the deer.
Yeah, he don't want them.
I cut all the hocks off, everything, and then I'd put them in a big freezer bag and freeze them, you know, and I'd keep them all in the freezer frozen, and then whenever I needed to make a scrape, I'd just take a handful out, put bucks and does, complete mixture, pack them in a jar and dump them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was fantastic. That worked for, I did that for years, and it worked great, but
yeah,
can't do it no more.
Right. Yep. But yeah, now, CWD. Now,
yeah. But I think the synthetic stuff works just as good.
Yeah.
I don't really. You just got to give it a little bit more time, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's a super good tool. And I'm still like trying to figure out, you know, the best method for me to use it. But I've definitely, you know, the last couple of years have kind of zoned in on those things and they're pretty effective, especially just you want to get, you know, pictures of a deer. I've yet to kill one over a mock scrape, but
I killed the one buck this year over it. So
nice.
But the problem with the mock scrapes is it also is a very good attractant for people.
Yeah, I know.
So that can be a problem. So like,
this, listen to this. This year in Indiana, we had a camera. I have a group of buddies that we all kind of share information, cameras and stuff around here. And he made a mock scrape and hung a camera. Now he hung it high and he has it on a bracket that, you know, hides a little bit, this and that. But like any self-aware person would see this camera that's 8 feet off the ground right there over this scrape, you know. This guy came to this scrape, took a rake, raked it out for like later on the year, raked it out and then poured some synthetic stuff into the already mock scrape and then hung a camera over it. Mm-hmm. And this whole time we're getting like pictures of this guy doing this. And it's just like, it's funny. You're right though. They do attract people.
Yeah. And that's why I don't really go too crazy with them close to where I think a buck is actually living.
That's a good tip.
Cause you're going to be trapping him for somebody else.
That's a really, really good tip because people do get, I mean, not that mock scrapes are a gimmick by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think they are, but people get into these things like they're like the end all be all and they put one everywhere, you know, at every stand location. And you're right, man. It's like can be a detriment to you. If you put them in certain spots that you don't want people to know about.
Yep. And that's, The good thing is, a lot of times when you find a big buck, he doesn't have a lot of sign around where he is anyway, you know?
Yeah.
I've seen that more often than not, like the old big bucks, like not just like a mature buck, the buck,
mm-hmm.
he won't have any sign around where he's living.
Yeah. Do you think you can screw him up by putting something close to him like that?
I don't necessarily think it's going to screw him up. If anything, it might piss him off.
Yeah.
You know, it can be good, but you don't want to get caught doing it.
Yeah.
You don't have, if somebody else finds it, then you just put a big sign up for everybody else to know where that deer is too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. And like, I'm probably good enough. Like I'm in the woods enough to know when it's like you can usually tell if it's a mock scrape, or especially if someone that doesn't really know what they're doing makes one maybe. But for an average guy just walking through the woods, they're just going to think like, oh, you know, look at all this sign right here. I'm going to sit here. So,
yeah.
Anyway, no, that's good stuff. That mock scrape topic has been a hot one the last couple of years. And
one thing I'll do is when I do make one, I will take zip ties and zip tie extra branches onto the scrape on purpose, and not so like somebody walks up to it, they can physically see there's zip ties on that branch.
Yeah.
I want them to know right off the bat that this ain't from deer.
Yeah, right. Get out of here.
Even though I probably have a lot of good deer on it, you know, but I want them to go, oh man, somebody built a mock scrape.
Yeah.
I don't want them to think it's natural.
Yeah. Do you freshen up scrapes with it a lot, or do you just let it be? Like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, if you have a scrape that's already active, will you?
Yeah. If I check the scrape and there's a ton of deer on it, well, I don't have to touch it.
Yeah.
I don't even walk near it at that point. I just leave it alone.
Yeah. Yep. All right.
That's what's nice about starting it early.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we've had luck with starting them even like in the late winter. Like, we'll get one going and deer will keep using it. Or, you know, at least acknowledge that it's there, and then come the fall, they'll end up using it. And I've even seen where we start a mock scrape somewhere in these hills where there was not very much, you know, scraping going on. Mm-hmm. And then the next year it's like they open up a whole bunch more around it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that before or not.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. If I see a spot even during the season and I go, wow, this would be a phenomenal spot for a mock scrape, I'm going to mark it and I'm going to start to scrape right there and then. Mm-hmm. Even if I don't have scent with me, I'm going to kick the dirt out and make the scrape. You know, I can do what I can do to make at least a visual point, you know, and then when I get a chance and I come back through, I'll put some scent in it or something.
Yeah.
Get it going.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people just do that method where they actually just open the thing up and make the visual, and then let the next fawn or whatever is going to come by and get interested in it, put some scent in it, and then get it going.
Yeah. Cause they smell that fresh earth.
Yeah.
You know, they smell that dirt getting tilled up and they smell that.
Yeah. Okay. We've already been talking for 35 minutes, but these things go so fast. I want to talk about gear with you a little bit, man.
Yeah.
What'd you use this year? You pretty much hunted out of a saddle all year, didn't you?
Yeah, I was hunting out of my saddle mostly. Up until like the last week, and I went back onto my tree stand for a while because I'm just getting saddle sore.
Yeah, I get it. I'm taking my B stand this trip. I'm probably going to be setting most of the day, and I was planning on having heavy clothes. It's going to be fairly warm this weekend, but
That's another issue with the saddles I always found too, is like late season when you're really wearing a lot of layers and stuff, they can be kind of a pain in the butt at that.
Yeah. I completely agree with you there. A lot of guys seem like they're doing that hybrid style now where they, you know, setting those little itty bitty stands with a saddle. And that's probably a good method of going about it. But to me, it's just, there's not the perfect hybrid stand out yet. So
my problem with it is I'm I can't use a little stand to begin with. I'm too big for it.
Yeah, true.
I get this big dead spot when I draw my bow straight ahead of me.
Yeah.
In a regular tree stand. Unless I'm in a full length platform, I can't get my elbow out of the
Yeah, I didn't think about that. But you made your own climbing sticks, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So what made you do that? Like, obviously there's all kinds of stuff on the market, or did you just see like something that you didn't like about all of them, made your own? Or,
well, when I made them, there wasn't any on the market.
Yeah, true.
Because I actually still hunt out of an old Arrow Hunter Kestrel saddle.
Yeah.
I bought that old Kestrel saddle. I never changed. But when they made that saddle, they didn't even make a platform yet.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, if you wanted the saddle hunt, you had to figure out what to do, because all you got is a saddle, you know? So,
right.
I got to make sticks. Like, I don't like any of the stuff that they make for sticks, you know? So I was like, I'm going to just make my own, you know? So I made big 24-inch long double steps.
Yeah.
Because everybody's got these little compact sticks today. I'm like, that's like these tiny little sticks that I'm not going to carry a half a dozen sticks to get up the tree. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially with you being a big guy, like you can handle a longer stride, but you also you weld aluminum for a living, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So my sticks weigh as light as any of the top end ones on the market.
Yeah. You know? What'd you make them out of? Are they just made out of like aluminum tubing, or what are they made out of?
Yeah, it's all aluminum tubing. And then there's no bolts on them because they're all welded together.
Yeah.
So I don't have any fasteners or anything. It's all just one big solid stick.
Yeah. Which is kind of like the beast, when Dan made the beast sticks, that was his concept. He didn't want any moving parts, so he wanted them all solid.
Yeah, mine are very similar to his.
Yeah.
I think he actually was building his sticks around the same time I was building my sticks on the forums.
Yeah.
Like, we probably both kind of got ideas off each other at some point. Who knows, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Yours are unique. You're a lot different looking than his, though. I mean, they're same concept, but like, it's not like either one of you really bummed the idea off of one another. It was yours are cool looking, though. Like, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. We just everybody wanted, like, it was like, okay, you want a double step. You know, that's going to be something that's going to be nice.
Yeah.
I like that the most, you know, but instead of having a long standoff on mine, I bent my steps. So my steps are bent on an angle going out. So when you step on them, you step kind of pigeon-toed on the tree with your heels together on the stick. And I found that was like the best way to do it for the way I was setting up. Because then you don't ever have to worry about putting your toes on the end of the stick. You got a good hard plant, you know, and then you're nice and tight with your lineman's belt when you're climbing.
Yeah. Yeah. They're super interesting. And I have like this, I don't know. I think homemade things are cool. Like, I would love to make my own sticks and just use them and not have to worry about this or that, you know?
Yeah. Cause I got the 24-inch stick, and then I have a 26-inch cableator on top of that, you know? So I'm already like beyond the length of a 3-step stick, you know?
Yeah.
With the cables out. So I only need to carry 2 sticks in the woods for most of this stuff I do.
Yeah.
2 sticks to a platform gets me like 17 feet right around there.
Yep. That is something that it's hard for manufacturers to like optimize some of their stuff because of the stupid safety rules they have to follow too, you know?
Yeah.
Not that I'm.
Yeah. I wish they make a longer stick available, you know?
Yeah.
For a tall guy, totally be useful.
Yeah, you know? For sure. I don't. Yeah. It's one of those deals where, I think the legally or whatever for insurance purposes, they have to have them 18 inches or less.
Yeah.
Something like that. So that's why Dan quit making his long one, because he did have like a 21.
Yeah, I remember he did. He had a longer one too.
Yeah, them, and they had to quit making them.
Yep.
I don't know if they had to, but they were advised to, or whatever the case may be, you know.
What one thing I think is a lot safer about using a long stick is it doesn't tend to want to kick out as bad.
Yeah, I could see that.
You don't get as many kick out issues with them, especially if you're on like really weird trees and stuff. The longer sticks, it's a lot more surface area to hold them in place.
Yeah. What attachment method do you use?
I use winch cable. Is what I'm using. It's AMS, basically. It's just synthetic winch cable for like an ATV.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's like 1,800 pound breaking strength or something.
Right.
So it ain't going nowhere.
And you do just like you have a button or some kind of tie thing, or how do you?
I work in the dock industry, so we use cleats on all the boat slips and stuff, like a boat cleat. So yeah. I designed an aluminum cleat that works like a boat cleat. So you throw your rope on there, and you just like you do a boat cleat,
like you're tying off a boat.
Yep, and then you just throw a security knot in there, and you're done. It takes probably 10 seconds to tie off.
That's a good idea.
All right. You could wrap up one of my sticks and put it away, or have it back out in probably 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Real quick process.
That's sweet. Then you're a saddle platform guy, but your saddle's modified too. It's like a Frankenstein, or your platform's like a Frankenstein looking thing.
Yep.
Oh, you don't use knee pads or a pad.
No, it's built in.
Yeah.
So I actually have a T bar built into the platform. So you put your knees right up to the bar.
Yep. Yeah. Which it's unique.
Yeah. What's nice about it is if I get into a really crooked tree, you know, I don't have to worry about where I put my knees on a tree. It's always the same, because it's going right against that T-bar built into the saddle post.
Yeah, it's gonna stay perpendicular to wherever that bracket is.
Yeah, it's consistent. So no matter what tree you get into, you're always hanging identically. You know, the only thing you got to adjust is where you put the tether on the tree for the angle of the tree. You know,
someone needs to hire you, Paul, to be a hunting equipment engineer. Yep. No, it's you guys, if you dig around on Paul's Facebook or something, you guys can find all his kind of inventions he has. If you snoop around enough, you'll find the saddle platform in a picture, or this or that, or his sticks.
Always doing something. If it's not that, buying trailers.
Yeah, dude. I've been working on my cargo trailer again. I got a vent I put a vent in the top, you know, just to let heat out or whatever. So I got that done today. Getting back on the kick. I've been thinking about nothing but deer hunting the last several months. So now I'm starting to do projects again.
I tell you, I'm pretty excited on mine now after Ohio. That worked fantastic.
Yeah, man.
It's great out there.
I do. I love that kind of stuff too. I was videoing it, you know, and I just like thinking to myself, like, I enjoy tinkering with that kind of stuff. And I'm like, you know, I'm glad I'm poor. Like if I was rich, I would have probably went and bought some fancy camper, but here I am like enjoying making my own, you know?
Yeah. Which is better, because there's nothing you could buy on a regular camper that's going to be 100% what you need for deer hunting, you know? No. And you're going to be covering the thing in mud and dirt and blood and guts all the time.
And they're built like crap anyway.
Yeah.
You know, they're not any better than what you'd be building. Probably what we did is better. You know, at least I know where all the wiring is and how it all works. And because I put it all together, you know, so I know exactly how to fix all of it.
Yeah. I purposely didn't put anything underneath anything. It's all my wires and extension cords. Yeah.
Me too. That's what I did. And I made a video about just like a little walkthrough of it. And I got so much hate for putting that wire on the outside of the walls. And I'm like,
it's the best.
I know. I was like, dude, I can work on, I can add lights, I can do anything I want. I don't have to take my walls down.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
But I did the same thing.
Build the walls of insulation and you're good to go.
Yep. That's what I did. Yeah. 1-inch foam board, put the walls up.
Yep.
The only thing I wanted, I'm thinking about doing, haven't decided yet, but I'm thinking about if I'm going to put a wood stove in it or I don't know.
I think the wood stove is the way to go.
Yeah.
It gets hot. You got to be able to.
Yeah. I got that bent now.
I actually cracked the whole back door to vent the thing.
Yeah. Cause it got too hot. It's like a freaking.
Oh, it's hot, but
yeah,
you want to eat, it's there. You know, clothes out and everything.
How long does it last? Of course, Paul made his own wood stove. He welded up his own, but
yeah, it's just like the size of a wood stove you would use in like a wall tent.
Yeah,
just a little itty bitty wood stove. You can actually buy them off of Sportsman's Guide and stuff like that. You can buy them for like $80 to buy them.
Yeah, little ones.
I probably spent $80 making one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but it's pretty cool though. The one you made. Yeah. There's only one like it.
Yep.
I think that's why I'm weird like that. If I had a choice, I have ran through my mind 100 times to go down to the local CNC shop in town here and ask them if they could make me my own little saddle platform and stuff that I have in my mind. I just think that stuff's cool. Doing your own thing. And, I don't know. That's why I'm so drawn to traditional archery sometimes, because this guy, the bowyer down the road, Scott, he made this one. There's only one like this and it's mine. It's cool. And I don't know. I think that stuff's cool. I think there's a lot to be said about doing stuff on your own and building something with your hands. That's an art that is slowly trickling away.
Yeah, that's it. I bought a lot of new clothing and stuff over the years, but I'll be running that forever now.
Yeah.
Once I find something that works, I don't switch it too often.
No. Well, I think there's so much marketing involved in hunting now that we lose sight of what is important for deer hunters, sometimes.
Yeah. And if anything, I think it handicaps us at some points, because you get this new piece of gear and you never fully get adjusted to what you had. And you're never 100% efficient with your gear you're using. And you're never all the way on your game with whatever you got.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, thankfully I did not run into problems this year, but I was extremely worried about that running a saddle this year. I mean, I was to the point where I was paranoid, which maybe that's why I didn't make any mistakes, but I was scared to death. I was not going to get a shot on my weak side, or, I was constantly thinking through those scenarios. Cause I'm like, I don't want to miss a deer. Cause I'm sitting in this stupid saddle,
Yeah.
Again, just a change in gear that I'm not used to. Now I'm used to it now and I feel confident, but at the beginning I was like, man, I don't know.
Or something just causes you to clank two things together and make a little noise. And that ruins your whole night.
Yeah. I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced that it didn't ruin my Wisconsin hunt early season. My saddle, that was the first hunt I took it on, and I had a what do they call them? The conduct, I think it's what's called, the cinders, and that's metal on metal, and I didn't know at the time that it was going to make so much freaking noise, but it was the carabiner that goes through it was making a little noise on me sometimes, and every time I'd hear that noise, I'd just be like, gosh, I about took the stupid thing off and just tied myself to the tree because I was so worried that I was going to move and that happened.
I'm like really critical on things like that.
Yeah.
Or like even like on your tree stand, like going through brush, if you hear branches smacking your aluminum and making noise on the back, on your back, you got to do something. You got to change something up, put something on there to stop that from happening.
Yeah.
Because you can't control a branch swinging back and hitting the end of the stand.
Yep.
And that deer, if it hits it right in the right time with the no wind or something, that deer could hear you 200-300 yards away.
Yep. And you get, I don't know what the right word is, but anytime you change something, sticks, stand, saddle platform, saddle, when you use a piece of gear for a long time, it becomes one with you. And you understand, I'm not going to hit it here. I'm not going to hit it there, you know, this will make noise, this won't make noise, and you lose that whenever you change something up, man.
Yep. Yeah, I could like run through the woods like a buck with antlers.
Yeah.
And on my back, because I know where my stand is oriented. You know, I know where everything's hitting. So I'll just.
Yep.
You don't even know you're doing it. Just a reflex to get through something.
Yep. Yeah. You run, what kind of pack do you run, Paul? Your pack kind of looks unique too.
Yeah. It's actually a bottom section of an old Peak One frame pack from the 1980s.
Gotcha.
Yeah. It's really nice though. It's a fairly large fanny pack.
Yeah.
And then it's got it's all fleece, and it has a waterproof liner on it. But it's got a fleece outside. So it's, what's really nice about that is it doesn't make any noise.
Right.
And then even the old hunting straps from back in the day, they made the straps out of a softer material that doesn't scratch when it hits branches and stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of this gear you see today kind of forgot about some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that we don't have those options sometimes, because.
And maybe I'm wrong here, but it seems like the hunting industry moves from west to east. Like, it seems like people develop things for Western hunters, like these packs that are noisy, because they're just, they're hauling crap around, you know, and then whatever.
It's a lot of open terrain out there.
Yeah, and maybe the animals that they're hunting is not as sensitive to that kind of thing, you know, that we as whitetail hunters deal with. But then that technology like moves into the whitetail world out east, and then we're like, then we have to figure it all out again. And I don't know.
Yeah,
it's funny.
I think what a lot of the big issue is with the Western stuff is, you know, you can see the game out there well before you get in range.
Right.
A lot of times, you know. So like, okay, yeah, I'll just throw my pack down and finish my stalk and get in close to these deer, you know, or I know they're there, so I know I got to be extra careful and quiet, you know. But as a whitetail hunter and hunting in forests and swamps, and we don't have that option. We don't know where those deer are until they're right on top of us.
Yeah.
You know, so our gear has to be quieter from the get-go in order to do the same task.
Now, that old pack, does it have like a, you said it's a frame, is it a frame pack, like it's a fanny though?
Yeah, I took the bags off of the frame.
Gotcha.
I just used the frame and the straps and stuff for my tree stand.
Yeah.
And the waist belt and everything. I took everything. And I just kind of gutted the frame and put it on my tree stand.
Gotcha. So that the fanny's actually on the, or do you not have like a fanny pack at all anymore?
The fanny pack just holds my gear, and it just gets bungeed down to the stand up.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's just big enough you can roll jack it up and cinch it down with it.
Right, you know. Right.
It's nice to have that too. So if I want to leave my set in the woods and come back in the morning, I could just put the fanny pack on and wear that out with all my gear, not have to carry the stand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I could tell the pack was different or old. I just was I was curious what it was. That stuff always interests me.
Yeah, nothing fancy. It's just a big old tube with the big zipper on it.
Yeah.
You know? I don't want to have all these 8,000 pockets with Velcro and buttons.
Yeah.
Too complicated. I just want something I can just throw a bunch of stuff in, pack it down, and close it.
Yep.
You know? And then you take the waist belt and you go right up around the tree and you clip the waist belt around the tree and cinch it down, and all your gear sits right there in front of you.
Yep. There is well, Rendell's on right now. We've kind of been talking to him about that. Like, there is a lack of good fanny packs on the market right now for deer hunters. In my opinion, I like a fanny pack too. Like, I carried a pack because of, I went to that saddle, you know, system. So I kind of had strapped things on those and, of course, my platform is different than yours. Obviously, yours is a custom Frankenstein one there. So, anyway, yeah, I ran a pack all year, but I'd love to have a good fanny pack. Anyway, let's see if there's any questions real quick. Paul. I think I saw a couple. I wanted to make sure we got to questions tonight because the last couple episodes I've skipped questions just for the sake of time. Oh, here we go. Slugworth asked, this is an interesting topic. He said, I've heard talk about DNR banning cams on public land in Wisconsin next year. Thoughts? I personally don't mind. That'd be interesting.
I'll deal with it. I don't really have Wisconsin. If they did it around me,
so be it.
So be it.
That's my attitude towards them too. I'd be like, well, save a lot of battery money.
Yeah. I didn't need them to kill big bucks before. It's just nice to have them, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's a very efficient tool. It's a good tool to figure out what you need to do next.
Yeah. And the cell cameras can be really tricky anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just promotes extra pressure on areas that you don't necessarily want.
I think that's what I can't remember. I was talking to someone in Kansas, or one of my buddies was talking to someone in Kansas. I can't remember how it was. It was a while back ago now. But we kind of brought up the question about why did they ban them there. And I guess it was what you just said. They just felt like there was getting too much too much pressure on the animals on public land.
So. Well, and that's like, I see it. I always saw it if I'm hunting in an area and I see a big buck moves into the area and I know there's a lot of cell cameras in the area, all of a sudden that weekend, all these trucks show up.
Yeah.
That haven't been in there the whole year. And now all of a sudden now there's five or six different guys hunting the same buck.
Yeah.
Like it happens too often to be coincidence anymore, you know.
Yeah,
I'm starting to focus on places that don't have self service, just to hunt, so I can
avoid.
Don't have to deal with it, because if I don't have self service in there, I don't see any cell cameras, and it doesn't seem to be as big of a deal.
Yeah,
you know? And I can just do my thing and hunt.
Yeah, and they do keep getting more affordable and cheaper, and like you could almost buy a cell camera as cheap as a regular card camera. And heck, I've heard some guys from Exodus, Jake, tell me he could see a day when you get the camera for free if you subscribe to their their data plan, mm-hmm. or whatever the case may be. You know, it's like, gosh, man, if that was the case, that'd be a mess. You know.
Yeah.
All right. Rendell had a really good question for us. He says, in hill country, do you tend to notice any trends in your mock scrapes placement that correlates with certain elevation? Like most of yours end up on tops, on bottoms, wind funnels, et cetera.
My terrain that I'm hunting is not just a normal hills. I'm more of like a expanded mountainous kind of terrain. Yeah. So it's like it doesn't really matter as much in like eastern, northeastern style mountainous terrain, like elevation. It's just the terrain focuses it in and makes the scrape, you know. But like when I go to Ohio, I definitely see like trends on certain features that are going to be more advanced. You'll find more scrapes down in the bottom, where like you get like a turkey foot or something going, or you're up on a top where they're more like a closer to like a saddle and a ridge or something like that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Rendell kind of elaborated later on in the comments. He says, I'm looking more for his percentages of the elevation he ends up choosing based on what the most bucks tend to do. So he's just wondering like, you know, where percentage wise do you usually end up putting more. I tend to put them in the bottoms is where I would say like the majority of mine are.
I run them in both, you know, depending on if I have top access or bottom access, you know, because I don't necessarily hunt off the scrape as much as I'm seeing what's in there, you know. So like, I just want to have that mock scrape in a location where it's awesome, you know.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
But even natural scrapes is the same kind of, you know, I don't think they're, I think it just kind of, it's more important on the habitat around it.
Right. Right.
The terrain that creates it.
Robert, we kind of answered this, but Paul, use a saddle or stand. I'm going to modify his question. Why do you choose a saddle over a stand, Paul?
I like the saddle for the shooting options. I do kind of like it for that, you know. I feel it's comfortable, and it weight wise, I don't think it matters anymore. There's so many advantages to a stand or a saddle today. With weight, there's no difference, you know. What do you got, a pound difference if you're unless you like using like a super ultralight system, which I'm not really a big fan of, a small platform or anything like that. I rather have a bigger platform, saddle platform and stuff, because I want to have maneuverability and as many shooting options as possible, you know. Because if there's anything that can hinder me in getting a shot off on a deer, I don't want it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want some kind of handicap, like weak side shots on a smaller platform are a lot harder to produce than like on a large platform, you know. You know, so I'll use a large platform. Like I could just stand up and stand on the platform and turn and shoot like a tree stand when it's coming in that way, you know. I don't have to like practice this fancy leaning maneuver kind of thing.
Yeah, you know? That was what was stressing me out about the saddle this year. So I need to go
like a hybridized version is the best, I think, something like hybrid.
Yep. You know? Yep. I think I agree with you there. I'm gonna do a little investigating this off season and stuff, and try to get maybe a little bigger platform. Yeah. Have you ever messed with like ring of steps around trees or anything like that, or on the backside of your
platform itself? The first year I had a saddle, I did, because that was it, and that's all you had.
Yeah.
Everybody was using Amera steps.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, the ring of steps with the Amera steps back in the day, and everybody was like going on eBay trying to find them because they were made, and you know.
Yeah, they weren't made anymore. I remember that. I made my first saddle platform. I made it out of a lone wolf seat.
Yep.
Yep. I just remember making it, and my dad was been like, he's like, "You need to be careful here, bud." I remember him being really concerned about what I was doing, because I was using this. You remember the old saddle sit drags?
Yep.
Remember people were making them out of that? I made me my own saddle. Yeah, I was using that, and then I had a homemade deal. My dad was just like, you know, I think he was seeing a little bit of him when he was young, making all of his own crap, because I couldn't, back then, I couldn't afford anything, you know. I was just a kid.
And that, what was it? Dryad.
Yeah, yeah.
They're very similar to a sit drag style.
Yep, yep, yep.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, back
that option. Available too.
Yeah, it's insane how many, like in the last 5 years, what has happened to that saddle market. Holy cow. I mean, there was nothing. I mean, you had to, the very first one I think I ended up getting that was a manufactured one. It was I think it was a Trophy line, but it had that, it was made by, it had like a Realtree Road Trips logo on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I did with that thing. I must have sold it or something, but it was, you know, an old one.
What was I going to say? The ring of steps, though, I don't use it anymore. You know, it wasn't working out for me, because sure, you could walk around the tree and shoot, but it's hard to walk around the tree when you got a bunch of deer standing there sometimes.
That's what I've always been a little confused on how people
pull it off. Where you could just kind of.
Yeah. Just like a tree stand.
Just like a tree stand. Exactly.
Yep. Yep. Oh man, let's see here. I've tried the saddle platform or the ring of steps as well. I still have one, but let's see here. Yeah, guys, this is just our opinions. If you like stand better, that's what I would use. We're not trying to talk about anything. Something. Yeah, sorry, there were just some people. There was a guy saying that's just your opinion. Like, yeah, that is. Like, I don't care. I didn't. I would have told you. I would have told you last year that I like my stand better, you know, and I still may. I don't know yet, you know. Yeah. But
I hunted all last year with a tree stand.
Yeah.
I didn't use my saddle until late season last year.
Yeah.
This year I flip-flopped it around.
Yep. I think it's just whatever you figure out and what you get comfortable with, man. Yeah. Like Paul, like you said earlier, Paul, everything is kind of equal now. Like, it's what you prefer.
Yeah. Now, it's all personal.
You're not getting a huge advantage one way or the other.
Yeah. Whatever makes you the most efficient is what you want to use.
Yeah.
And then find that piece of gear and stick with it.
Gotcha. Sorry, DK. I didn't, I read your comment wrong. I know you weren't, bashing us or anything, dude. Don't worry about it. My bad. All right, Paul. We've been on here for over an hour now, and we're out of questions. So, thanks for coming on, dude. We could probably sit here and chit chat enough, and people would start asking them again. We need to get on one of these days and just talk about mountain bucks. And before we got on here, we were talking about your season a little bit. You said a decent season. Killed some deer. So
I've been doing a lot of missing this year. That's not good.
Yeah. That's something else.
Bad year for that.
Yeah. That's something else that me and you were talking about over Messenger was release aids and bow and arrow.
I keep getting opportunities at low light and I'm messing up. I hit a branch twice in bow season, and then I blew a shot on a nice buck with a rifle in Pennsylvania. I couldn't hit him. I missed him. He was going, and I didn't get him. I cut down the forest. But,
Here you go. What broadheads you shoot, Paul? There's a question Robert has.
Right now I'm shooting the Sever mechanicals.
Yep. You like those a lot, don't you?
Yeah, I've had really good luck with them. So
yep, a lot of people really like those heads. I shot all my deer with the expandable this year too.
Yep,
they worked.
Yeah, they did a job.
Yep,
the second buck I shot, I punched him right through the shoulder, quartering to him, at like 18 yards on a downward angle, and that broadhead was fine. Didn't do nothing.
All right, Paul, thanks for hopping on here, man. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Always a pleasure chit-chatting about deer hunting with you. So if you guys, before you leave, hit the subscribe button if you aren't subscribed already, and we will see you next week on another episode. Thanks, Paul. See you, everybody.
Yep.